for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Congress scrambles as time runs out to fund the Department of Homeland Security. GOP hopefuls flock to the annual Conservative Political Action Conference, and the FCC approves net neutrality rules. Here for the Domestic Hour, the Friday News Roundup, Chris Freitz of CNN, Gene Cummings of Bloomberg News, and syndicated columnist Steve Roberts of the George Washington University. Don't forget, you can see all of our guests on our live video stream at drshow.org, and you can call into the program, 800-433-8850. You can send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Happy Friday, everybody.
Good morning, Diane.
Good
Friday
to see you all. Chris Freitz, I'll start with you. What's the latest on congressional action on Homeland Security?
Well, the latest is right now the Senate is considering a bill. They're going to put up two bills, one that would fund the Department of Homeland Security, and then another bill that would challenge the president's executive authority on immigration reform. And that's been a compromise that Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has had to come to because he has tried four times. He's brought up the House bill four times, which combines those two things. The House Republicans are very intent on using the Homeland Security funding to express their disapproval of President Bush's use of executive power. Now, the Democrats in the Senate have said, no way. We're not going to allow you to tie the one thing to the other. And they have a pretty strong argument by saying that they're putting the nation's security at risk by trying to tie the immigration issue to this bill. And so it looks like what we'll see here this morning is that the Senate will vote on a what they call a clean immigration bill just to fund the Department of Homeland Security. And then if that happens, the Democrats will allow a vote also to express their disapproval of the president's executive order on immigration, which gave about 5 million people protected them from deportation. So that's where we are.
That's in the Senate. Over in the House, as we are here chatting, they are supposed to be coming close to having a vote of their own. And that would be to extend the Homeland Security funding for 3 weeks and then create a conference committee that would then meet with the Senate to try to reconcile the two different approaches that the chambers have taken.
Now, how long would all that take?
Well,
and what would happen to employees in the meantime?
If they were to pass the three-week extension, then the employees would be fine until the end of that three-week period. However, as in the Senate, the House bill is not an easy lift. The Democrats have made it clear they're whipping against it. They are not going to give their votes to help pass a short-term measure. That means that Speaker Boehner has to get 218 out of his own caucus. And there are anywhere from 25 to 50 conservatives over there who want to take a harder approach, who don't want to extend it for 3 weeks, who want to forge ahead with their own bill, which would defund the immigration planks of immigration program that's within the Homeland Security Department, which coincidentally was going to this week begin implementing part of that program. So Speaker Boehner doesn't have an easy time of it, and the fact that this big conservative gathering is in Washington at this moment, CPAC is here, that makes it even harder for him.
Steve? Look,
what we're really seeing is a fascinating difference between the House and the Senate, partly in terms of their traditions and their rules. A majority in the House can do what it wants. The Republicans run the House. They can pass any kind of bill they want. They run the Senate, but only partially, because the Senate rules require 60 votes to get past a filibuster. So that's one of the key differences. The big fight here is not between the Republicans and the Democrats. It's within the Republican Party. So it's partly the rules that are different and the traditions that are different. It's also a theory of government. The Republicans who run the Senate have said, look, the public has given us authority to govern, to run things, to get something done. We have to show in these 2 years before we run again that we can use this authority responsibly. Whereas in the House, you have a lot of Republicans saying, we're not really interested in governing. We're interested in making speeches and stating our pure ideological position. So you have the clash of rules and the clash of approaches to government. And that's what's really holding everything up.
And what happens if nothing gets done, Chris?
If nothing gets done, the Department of Homeland Security will not be funded. Many of those critical Homeland Security employees will not get paid, and that's a problem. And a lot of Republicans are worried about going off yet another cliff. We've heard about the fiscal cliff. We've heard now we have the Homeland Security cliff, and it feeds into this idea that Steve was just talking about can Republicans govern? When they campaigned in the fall, they told America, if you elect us to run Congress, we're going to run it efficiently. There's no more of, you know, this infighting. And what you're starting to see is the infighting seems only heightened.
I think that this start of this Congress is just exactly what Speaker Boehner and Majority Leader McConnell feared. This is not at all how they wanted the Congress to start. They wanted, you know, they had to take a few quick votes that were important for their base. They had to act on health care. They had to act on Keystone. They made those promises. They had to do it fast. Keystone took longer than it should have. And now this is upon them. And even if the House gets its way, then 3 weeks from now, we're in the same position.
Exactly.
And they've spent 2 months now on Keystone and a possible government partial shutdown.
And there's a history here, because a lot of Republicans say, look, we've tried this before. We have shut the government down before, and we've lost politically as a result. There's a Congressman, Peter King, a Republican from Long Island, said yesterday after the House caucus decided we're going to keep fighting, and he said he called his own members self-righteous and delusional. Now, that's a Republican. That's not a Democrat. And so there are these very serious splits, Diane, between people who say we're here to govern and people who say we're here to make speeches.
And that is the voice of Steve Roberts. He's syndicated columnist and professor of journalism at George Washington University. You can see him, Gene Cummings, Chris Freitz. If you'd like to, we are video streaming this hour. You can go to drshow.org and click on Watch Live. You mentioned Keystone, Gene. President has vetoed. How do we go from here?
Well, we go from here in a couple directions. First of all, the president has not made a decision about Keystone. And the White House made it clear that his veto was more about the legislation than the project itself. He wasn't going to be ordered by Congress to do this project. It's within his power to decide whether Keystone goes forward, and he's going to retain that power. So that's why he vetoed the legislation. They don't have the votes to override the veto. So when it comes to Congress at the moment, that's that.
He now says he's waiting for the report from the Department of State.
Yes. The State Department was charged with doing an impact study on Keystone. They've already issued one. They were waiting for a court case that involved Nebraska to finish up. It did. It's now behind them. The courts have approved the path through Nebraska. And so now the State Department can finalize their report. That report, in its initial form, suggested that the pipeline would have not significant environmental impact. And so that's kind of the core finding that people were looking to get out of this. Now, what does the president do? He has spoken very negatively recently about the Keystone pipeline. On environmental terms and economic terms, that it doesn't create many jobs.
Right.
And it's more a boon to Canadian oil companies than to any company in the U.S. because it just runs through the U.S., gets it out to the ports, and off it goes.
Look, you know, we talked a lot, fairly, about the Republicans having to deal with their base voters. this, to some extent, is a case of Democrats having to deal with their base voters, particularly the environmental activists, who are a very important part of the Democratic constituency. And they have made this an extremely important litmus test for this president. And, of course, the whole larger issue of climate change is important to this president. He sees it as one of those areas where he can leave a legacy. And so, in many ways, the Keystone fight is symbolic. It's not about a lot of practical impact. It's about basically, which side are you on the climate change fight? And that's what the president is saying.
And the other thing that I think we should look for about what the president does on Keystone is I would not be surprised if he uses this as a bargaining chip with Canada. Remember that the president right now is in talks trying to get a climate deal with Canada. He has a climate deal with China. He has a climate deal with India. He may use the Keystone pipeline as a chip in that negotiation to try to get something out of it. Mike Bloomberg called him to do just that earlier this week.
Chris Freitz, CNN. Short break here. When we come back, we'll talk about the vote on the FCC on internet freedom, equality. Short break, right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure all students graduate from high school prepared for success in college and career and supporting innovation that can improve public schools at gatesfoundation.org. From the Simons Foundation, working to advance research in basic science and mathematics. More information is available online at simonsfoundation.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
Welcome back to the domestic hour of our Friday News Roundup. You can not only hear the program, you can see it if you like. Go to drshow.org and click on live. Two emails, the first from Jeff. So, will the voters ever punish legislators for stunts like this Homeland Security funding? I understand this is the way things go. Why should Republicans not try this sort of ploy?
Well, look, if you're talking about the basic conservative Republicans from the House of Representatives who are the driving force in shutting down the government, would they pay a price? The answer is no, because they're in districts that are so heavily drawn to favor Republicans that there's no accountability. But if you talk about a larger question of a Republican candidate for president running with this hanging over his head, then I think it can be a bigger issue, but
well,
not in those individual
that's
districts.
That's the question. Here's one from Claire who says, everyone says the GOP shut down the government and paid for it. They got blamed, but they won overwhelmingly in 2014. So in what way did it harm them? I'm glad they think it harmed them, so they'll stop doing it. but I don't really see what harm they incurred.
Chris. Well, I think at the time of that shutdown, you started to see the damage pile up in terms of a national conversation about whether or not Republicans can govern, whether they should be trusted with the Congress, and whether they should be trusted with the presidency. But remember what happened then. Then Obamacare, the website, blew up. And that saved Republicans, I think, from a lot of the wrath of the last government shutdown, because it sucked all the oxygen out of the air and then turned to the question to, well, can the president's program work? And should we trust Democrats and their programs to make life better? And I think in that way, they got a pass. Republicans know they got a bit of a pass and they don't want to return that.
And you have just defined what it means to have a merry-go-round in Washington.
Well, the other thing, though, that is a real outcome is that shutdown sparked the Republican Civil War. And that had real consequences on some members of their own party. And that's what we're seeing Speaker Boehner still grapple with today. The Republicans spent, my memory serves me right, we did a story in August, it was $100 million. On primary fights. So there was cost, but it was different than what the caller may have in mind, and that fight isn't over yet.
All right, let's turn to the action of the FCC, Steve, on net neutrality. Briefly, explain what they did.
Well, basically what they did was make a decision that has been out there for a long time, been debated. Should this whole new digital network be treated as a public utility? Up until now, it's been viewed as a technological innovation. But in some ways, they're really victims. The inventors and the developers of the net are almost victims of their own success. They have become so critical to American life that the FCC...
You can't apply for a job.
Of course not. The FCC has said, look, they have become so successful and so important, we have to regulate them. Now, they said, we will regulate them, quote, with a light touch, because there's a lot of criticism from Republicans and others saying, look, the whole genius of the web is free innovation and entrepreneurship and the vitality of new ideas. And so the trick for the FCC is, how do you say there's a public benefit to regulation, a public responsibility to regulation, but not to overregulate where you suffocate.
Tricky balance.
Yeah.
Chris.
Very tricky balance. And part of what the debate is over is this idea of fast lanes. And should companies, broadband companies, be allowed to charge your Amazons and your Netflix more money to stream their services faster than some of the other smaller sites? And activists who are against this idea say, no way. I mean, the whole idea of the internet is that everybody's sites load at the same speed. So whether you're Jeff Bezos and you're a billionaire with a website, or you're a guy trying to launch the next billionaire website, you should have the same speed. Now, the broadband companies will say, well, that was a great model when not everybody was on the internet all the time. Uh-huh. And now we need to build bigger pipes. We need to invest in better infrastructure. And to do that without charging everybody lots more, we could tier it.
And the FCC said they were going to stay out of the financing of it, not get into questions of who pays how much.
Yeah, I mean, basically, this is a fight about money. That's what it is.
Sure.
I mean, everybody wants everyone to have wonderful internet access. So what this is really about is, can the companies that do, as Chris said, they need to build more pipes, they need to build more delivery systems, and they want more money to do that. And so this was, as Chris said, a way to generate that kind of income. I just want to make one note following up on what Steve was saying, because you all had, NPR had a great show on this.
Yes,
and yes, and there also was an interview with a communications historian who likened the internet to AT&T.
Right.
And how the telephone companies were so, it's not just in America, globally, were so critical that access, everyone have access to the phone company in a fair way in order to do business, in order to do commerce. And that's where the Internet is today. It is the new AT&T.
And, you know, there's also a much larger philosophical debate here that's been true in America for close to a century. You got to remember, the law that the FCC is harking back to was passed in 1934, which originally to try to give them powers to regulate telephones and other things. And the debate is basically this. You got conservatives who say the free market needs to flourish, it needs to be unregulated, and it needs to see its powers and of innovation. The other side says you need regulation in order to not just control the free market, but to enable it to reach its full potential. And it's really a long-standing philosophical argument about the role of regulation in the economy, and does it help or hurt the economy? And that's one of the key differences between Democrats and Republicans on many issues.
And we're likely to see a number of court challenges
and
to
in Congress,
this ruling.
Yeah. Unlike Keystone, this one's just starting.
Exactly. Okay, let's talk about this year's Conservative Political Action Convention that is underway just outside Washington. Jeb Bush is speaking today. Who else have been the big stars, and what's their message, Jean?
Well, yesterday they had a lineup of about four, and then today they have another four or five. Jeb Bush this afternoon being the one everybody's watching, because the question is whether, while he's wooing Wall Street and trying to push a more moderate message on immigration than his party embraces, can he win over the activist base that is represented at CPAC?
Is he conservative enough?
Exactly. And I think it's funny, Jeb Bush is bussing in supporters from downtown Washington to make sure there are some friendlies in the crowd. That's going to be a much watched event.
He's
but I think yesterday,
in
yes,
people,
yeah, they're getting picked up at DuPont Circle and brought out to the hotel where the event's taking place. But I think yesterday's star was Scott Walker, and that's as opposed to Chris Christie. They were both there, and Christie chose not to give a speech. This crowd is really geared towards a speech where they can hit the applause lines and that sort of thing. He chose not to use that vehicle and instead do a Q&A with a tough questioner, Laura Ingraham.
Yeah.
And it walled him off a little bit from the crowd. It was an intimate conversation between the two of them, with the audiences, you know, just there to watch. Walker, jacket off, sleeves rolled up, went out, hit almost every note except one. He did misspeak a little bit about taking on ISIS, in that he compared the terrorists to the protesters in his home state. So that was a mistake.
Yeah.
But otherwise, he hit the notes right.
And on the Jeb Bush front, I talked to some folks in Bush World, and I said, what are you guys doing bussing in, you know, folks from downtown? And they said, well, you know, the Bush network is very big. We had some folks who said, you know, we could use some transportation to get over there. It's all the way at National Harbor across the river, so we're going to do that. But when I said, well, what does Jeb want to go for today when he talks this afternoon? And they said they really want to dispute this moderate label. They will tell you that there's only two issues where he is really different than the rest of the Republicans. That's on Common Core curriculum in education and on immigration. And I think we can expect to see from Jeb, you know, the message that I cut $19 billion in taxes. I vetoed $2 billion in spending. I had $9 billion in reserve as governor of Florida. That's a very conservative record. I think they want to take that record to this audience. And I think if Jeb plays this well, he's this will be the first time he's able to sell these guys on his conservatism, and he needs to win that.
And what about Scott Walker and how well he did yesterday?
Absolutely, and I think that ups the ante for Jeb. He needs to. That's the level now that he needs to perform.
You know, there's also, in addition to people being bussed in, there's also talk that a number of people will walk out when Jeb Bush speaks. And he gave a speech
because,
he, as Chris says, he on these two key issues, immigration, Common Core, and he made a speech yesterday in Florida where he reiterated his strong commitment. He's not backing off on those issues. They are a non-starter for a lot of the people in CPAC. And this also reflects the larger problem the Republican Party has. CPAC is full of ardent, passionate people who have outsized influence in the primary process, because in early primary states, they tend to vote, they tend to organize. But these are not the people who are going to elect the next president. And Jeb Bush has said over and over again, my key problem is how do I at least marginally please this base and still preserve my ability to appeal to a larger national audience?
In other words, how do I get through the primaries?
Exactly right. And he is, and the other thing about his that speech about what he did as Florida Governor, Chris, I was reading that because he said this, virtually that same thing at Club for Growth yesterday in Florida. It sounded pretty old. You know, talking about his tenure as governor of Florida.
And that's the knock on him, is he hasn't campaigned in over a decade.
We all know a basic truth about American politics. American politics is always about the future, not the past. And a presidential candidate who, and Hillary Clinton's got to have this risk, too. You know, if you talk too much about something that happened 10 years ago, you sound pretty out of date. And I had that feeling when I heard him.
And it was, CPAC convention was the first time log cabin Republicans were invited to speak. What are they talking about?
Well, I think obviously they're talking about marriage equality, and you see Republicans have shifted on that issue. As the country has shifted, you will notice that no presidential hopeful at this point has gotten up and talked a lot about gay marriage. And that's because it does not play with the base. The people at CPAC, still are largely in the traditional marriage camp. But the nation as a whole is coming, around to the idea of gay marriage. It's legal in, I think, a majority of states now. And that's another area where a candidate doesn't want to highlight that difference between the base and toward where the rest of the country is going.
Chris Fritz of CNN, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Well, we talked about CPAC. Let's talk about Hillary Clinton making a speech to 5,000 women out in Silicon Valley. How'd that go, Jane?
Generally, we're starting to see the outlines of her messaging for her campaign. This is the first of three speeches that she'll give that are related to women. And she's talking about equal pay. She's talking about how women's economics are about family economics. They don't just affect women. They affect the family as a whole. That includes husbands, brothers, and sons. In that address and Q&A, she also got tossed a lot of other issues where she stood pretty much by the president in the handling of national security issues. Mm-hmm. So it was more wide-ranging than the gender issue, although that's what everyone focused on, because what she has been signaling for months now, that was not the first time, for months, that she's much more comfortable in her own skin. And she has already proven, when she ran in 08, she had to prove she was tough enough. And so she was brittle. She was always on guard that she would look tough. Well, she's proven that now. She doesn't have to worry about that anymore. And now she could be more of herself. And when you talk about the past, the way that they hope to get past the, you're the old school, you're the old Clinton administration, is that she's history. She's the future.
And one of the symbols of future for her is her granddaughter. I think you're going to hear a great deal about this during the campaign. She already started this. She did this very engaging tweet during the debate over vaccinations when Chris Christie and others made some false steps. And she sent out a tweet saying, Grandma knows best. You're going to hear a lot more about this, because this is a way to talk about the future, about my granddaughter's world and the world she's going to grow up in. And it's a way to connect to her role as a mother and grandmother. And, those roles, parent, politician, candidate, those are political.
Absolutely.
Roles. Parent is not a political job, and it humanizes her in a very different way.
But she's also facing some questions and even criticisms about the contributions made to her fund, her educational fund, while she was Secretary of State, Chris.
Well, that's right, Diane. And what we learned this week was that there were seven foreign governments that had given to the Clinton Foundation, and one of those donations from Algeria was for $500,000, and that violated ethics laws. And this story is important because it kind of shows the breadth and the depth of the Clinton network and how, while that can be very helpful to her presidential campaign, it is also going to raise questions about appropriateness. Was it appropriate for a foreign country to give $500,000 to her family's foundation while she was a Secretary of State? And what you're going to see from Republicans and opponents of Hillary Clinton is an idea that she's, you know, part of influence peddling, and that is going to come back, I think, time and again, that one of her greatest strengths is this network, but it's also going to raise questions about what did they want from her.
Chris Freitz of CNN, Gene Cummings of Bloomberg, and Steve Roberts. He's professor of journalism at George Washington University, as well as a syndicated columnist. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, they're all here to answer your questions, so stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, home of cancer fighters, part of the care team that connects cancer patients with others who are being treated for a similar diagnosis to provide emotional support while they undergo treatment. Learn more at cancercenter.com. From PwC. PwC, the right people to get the extraordinary done. Learn more at pwc.com/extraordinary. And from the National Endowment for the Arts, art works.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, the U.S.-Israel rift widens over Prime Minister Netanyahu's stance on Iran. Russia threatens to cut off gas supplies to Ukraine and Western Europe. And Jihadi John has been identified as a British national. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. We've got a number of other things to talk about. Quickly, the showdown over pot in D.C. Tell me about it, Chris.
Well, the District of Columbia voters passed by 65% a legalization ballot initiative in November that allows residents to possess up to 2 ounces of marijuana, to grow up to 6 plants of marijuana, and to possess it legally. However, they cannot sell it. So you could give it to your friend, you could gift it, but you couldn't sell it. And the idea was that if that passed, then the city government would create rules around how to implement this piece of legislation.
Well, one member of Congress has threatened to throw the mayor into jail.
Congressman Jason Chaffetz of Utah, who's head of the House Oversight Committee, is threatening hearings, is threatening investigations, is threatening a whole lot of stuff.
About taxation without representation. Right.
What I also find amazing is if you go to CPAC, there are there's a whole little wing that's wants to legalize marijuana. These are the libertarians who are out there. So this is not, I mean, this is meddling, but it's also
when
not
When I sat down with Chaffetz earlier this month, I put it to him and I said, you know, Congressman, Republicans talk about states' rights. They talk about limited government. You know, how do you answer the question that you are acting in the opposite way? And he said, well, the District of Columbia is not a state. And Congress has authority over it. And so what they did was essentially they put a rider into the huge spending bill that passed at the end of the year that said you cannot implement this.
But this raises this very interesting question. You raised about gay marriage, too, earlier. There are two kinds of conservatives. That's a big tent. There are religious conservatives who believe in using government to enforce certain values. But there are libertarian conservatives who believe very strongly in favor of legalization of and in favor of gay marriage.
Here's the question. Is Muriel Bowser going to jail?
No. She is not. That is rhetoric.
Is the use of marijuana, which is now legal according to the District of Columbia voters, is it going to be used?
It will be used. And what the D.C. government's trying to do is to make clear what is legal and what isn't. It is illegal to use it on federal lands.
Which is about 25% of the district.
Right. Okay. It is illegal to use it outside. So they want residents to know what really can you
do. So you can
smoke it in your house. Yes, pretty much.
And you can grow it.
Only 6 plants, 3 big, 3 small.
Okay.
Don't know who's got the ruler.
Okay. And then you may possess no more than 2 ounces. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Well, Mayor Bowser, I hope you stay out of jail.
But I think it will go to the courts.
You do.
I do. I think there is so much gray area now without there being rules around it that this fight is not over yet.
Okay, let's go to Jason in Norfolk, Virginia. Hi there, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning.
Hi.
Just stemming from what y'all were saying there about the issue with the Department of Homeland Security, I'd like to get a response from the guy who was saying that people in the House are not governing. How is it to not govern to disallow the president from doing whatever he wants, particularly when the Department of Homeland Security is absolutely intrinsic to executive amnesty? I'd like to hear a response to that question.
Steve.
Well, look, I understand the argument. The Republicans who oppose the president say he acted illegally. The problem is, how do you then act in a governing circumstance? You don't have the ability to put legislation through the Senate. They've tried, as Chris pointed out, 4 times, and it's failed 4 times. And even Republicans have said you've got to face reality. So governing is about reality. Governing is about dealing with the hand you're dealt, not with how you would like it to be. So you can say, as the caller does, fair enough, the president acted illegally, but you don't have the power within the structure now to stop him. And that's what a lot of Republicans are talking about.
And the Republicans are saying that it's in court, let the courts handle it.
All right, let's go to Calgary in Alberta, Canada. Greg, you're on the air.
Hi, I just had a quick comment. You talked about CO2 emissions out of the oil sands, and the University of California has done a study and shown there's fields in California that produce more CO2 emissions from source to wheel end. But the big question is, TransCanada, which wants to build the Keystone, is going to put a proposal through to build a pipeline out of North Dakota into Saskatchewan to join up with the Energy pipeline and get this Bakken oil off of the rail and into a pipeline. And everybody needs to remember, this is the oil that burnt the town of Quebec, and all the fiery crashes in the U.S., upper rail cars, has been this Bakken oil. This oil needs to be underground. So what's your president going to do when it's a domestic oil supplier and TransCanada wants to build a pipeline across an international border?
Well, Greg raises a very legitimate point, and that is the idea that if we don't build Keystone, they won't dig up the oil. That's not true. They're going to bring the oil out, and then they'll transport it somehow. And they can do it by train. They can do it by car. By truck. That would be funny. But at any rate, it's not going to stay in the ground.
It's going to move.
And so that's why you start to hear some of these new alternative solutions like the diplomatic approach. Use it in, use this to find a way to put more pressure on the markets internationally by getting more Western oil out there so that it loosens the hold maybe that Russia has on Europe. You know, there are arguments in the international community that can be made on behalf of TransCanada, especially given that, like I said, it's going to be drilled.
All right. Let's go to Devin in Orlando, Florida. Hi there. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question about the FCC ruling, and from one of the things that I understand currently about the ruling is how cities, or it's now giving cities more freedom to choose what ISPs operate within their boundaries. So I want to know, I guess this is a twofold question, how accurate is that? And then the other part is, if that is accurate, what are the implications that are current for the cities that keep them from choosing those ISPs?
You know, Devin, yesterday when we did the program on the FCC ruling, we did not get into the various municipalities because it's very complicated. And each area, each city, each municipality may have its own rules. Chris?
Well, I think that's absolutely right, and I can't speak to Devin's question about, you know, from a city-to-city standpoint, but I know that there is frustration often in cities. In D.C., for instance, it's largely Comcast, and, you know, RCN has come in, but those rules are often done by the city council, and there are a lot of things, kind of a lot of moving parts there that I think we're going to have to see how they play out.
And the larger theory behind the FCC ruling was if you make this a public utility, you try to regularize some of these rules. There was a second ruling. They actually made two rulings yesterday, and one invalidated two cities, smaller cities,
right,
and their rules. And this is the larger
one
theory that
Tennessee.
you have this patchwork now of local rules, and part of the argument for having the FCC take control is to have a more predictable, more regular national system.
Good point. And to Michelle in Thomasville, North Carolina. Hi there.
Hello, good morning. I wanted to speak to the conversation you had about the 2016 election.
Sure.
It sounds like your panel seems to think that the Democrats are going to put all their eggs in the Hillary basket. Is that really the likelihood? And then a follow-up to that would be, what do you see as the possibility of maybe a Biden ticket, ideally like a Biden-Warren ticket?
Interesting questions. And we do know, by the way, since she mentioned Elizabeth Warren, that Hillary Clinton did have a private conversation with her. Is everybody putting the Hillary into that front runner position?
Yes. In a word.
Yes.
Absolutely.
I don't think Elizabeth Warren has made it pretty clear, I think,
She's not running.
I think she'll run in the future at some point, but not this year. Biden would love to run, but only if Hillary does not run. And as Gene pointed out earlier, every sign, the speeches that Hillary is giving this week, are a clear sign to her supporters and her funders that she's going ahead.
We should note that we do have another Democratic candidate who's testing the waters. That's former Virginia Senator Jim Webb. And, of course, there are always the rumors about Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, who has done, you know, taken some steps to maybe lay some scaffolding for something. But if Jim Webb gets in, that could be interesting because Hillary has not debated for a long time. And he could challenge her on issues and maybe sharpen her message, because he's very smart on national security issues.
Do you think he could raise the kind of money he would need to?
No. He doesn't. He's not going to beat her.
No,
but he
I'm
might
not
be able to help
that.
Her.
Right.
He
and
might be able
help.
To help her in that she would be practiced. And practice is important because a lot has changed since she ran for office in 2008. A lot has changed. And so, I mean, there are many Democrats who believe that she would benefit from some sort of primary challenge just to sharpen her message and her skills.
And Michelle makes an interesting point when she talks about Biden and Warren. I think, there's a hunger for some of that more progressive edge. And while it's clear that Elizabeth Warren's not going to run for president, she's also withholding her blessing from Hillary Clinton. When you read how she talks about Hillary Clinton, she's not out there gushing about her. She's holding back because she's trying to shape some of Clinton's agenda to be a little bit more progressive on things like Wall Street reform and the big banks. And so look for Warren to play that role. The other caveat, of course, is that I think we all probably sat at microphones like this back in 2006 and 2007 and said Hillary Clinton was the one, and then Barack Obama showed up. So there's always the chance that a candidate who nobody saw coming catches that lightning in a bottle. It's very rare, which is why 08 was so exciting, but it's possible.
And the other fear under the surface that Democrats talk about, let's remember Hillary Clinton did run before. She ran in 2008, as Chris said. She lost. She lost to a one-term, unknown senator from Illinois. And her political skills are still in question. And they include not just her policies on Wall Street and the question of whether she can bring in the left. I think that's very important, Chris. The other issue that I think is out there is, can she relate to people on a personal level? Can she connect? Can she say, I understand what your life is like? That's why I mentioned earlier the grandmother role. I think there's going to be a very important mechanism for her. But if you look at the speech she gave in California, yes, she spoke to 5,000 people, an important number. She also made $300,000 for that speech. And that can be a burden. That can be an argument Republicans can use. Say, look, this woman doesn't understand you. She's out there making $300,000 speeches, and she's a creature of Wall Street.
But, as First Lady, she certainly had that touch. And it's going to surprise me if he and
But she didn't have it as a candidate in 2008.
I understand that. She was a candidate. But all I'm saying is, as First Lady, she had that personal touch. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. All right, let's go now to Joe in Toledo, Ohio. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Love your show.
Thanks.
I had a question here on the FCC and the net neutrality. And I have two children that are in school right now, and they are having to do all their homework on the internet, and that's opened a lot of doors to them, and me having to always look over their shoulders to what they're doing. And I'm wondering, will there now be able to be parental controls on the internet like there are with your television set, or them, what kind of websites they'll be able to get onto and not get onto if you wanted to set something like that up?
Yeah, there are many of those services already in play where you can block websites. So, yes, I don't know that necessarily that would be part of any kind of government
Said
regulation.
By the mother of a 15-year-old.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, I have a 15-year-old, so I hear you, Joe. I hear you. But, yeah, you can those services are actually offered by the companies themselves. I'm not sure that the government would ever really need to get involved because there's just a consumer demand as parents
The FCC ruling does not imply that they're going to regulate content, I think, in any significant way. It's more the rules of the road and the money that you all talked about earlier rather than the content.
All right. We've got to end on this black and blue dress controversy. I see that Speaker John Boehner has weighed in on this. He says the dress is blue and black. The whole thing comes up because the mother of the bride wore white and gold, or was it blue and black? How can a dress posted on the web look to some people, as it did to you and to me, Chris, as though it's gold and white? How can other people say it's blue and black?
Well, if I'm remembering, I read it last night because my daughter and I went round and round on this. I see blue and black. She looked at me like I was from Mars.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
This is gold and white.
She looks at you like she was. You were from Mars every day.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay, so maybe this was a Jupiter moment. But, but at any rate, I believe if I remember the article right, it's they're claiming that it has something to do with our thyroid levels. And if you're up, you see this. If you're down, you see that. Or
so
and that there is actually some third color group that you can see, too, which no one in my house
saw. Okay, but so Susan Casey brought that photograph in. Chris and I looked at it and said, it's gold and white. And you said, it's
you guys
blue
are so wrong.
Oh,
it's totally
God.
Blue and black. No,
here's, I'm going to bring this all back to politics because the new world in which Hillary Clinton, who hasn't run since 2008, Jeb Bush, who hasn't run until since 2002, both of them are facing a world where something like this can explode on the internet within minutes. And this is part of the environment they're going to have to deal with as they become a candidate.
All right, we'll leave it at that. And I'm sure it's going to go even farther, this debate. We'll see how it comes out and whether it has to do with my thyroid or yours.
But just for the record, I would not wear that dress to a wedding.
Okay.
No matter what color.
Gene Cummings of Bloomberg, Chris Freitz of CNN, Steve Roberts. He is syndicated columnist and professor of journalism. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.